From the Carter Subaru Studios, this is the G and Ursula Show with G. Scott and Ursula Voitin.
Yes, it is the day before Thanksgiving, and so we want to hear from all of you just what you're thankful for. 98973 is the text line. And also, if you could post your thoughts on our G and Ursula Facebook page, that would be great too. Make sure you like us, by the way. Coming up in about 25 minutes, we will be discussing family, considering this is the best time of year to do that, considering what we're all thankful for. Ursula, we have a guest.
We do. And I just want to set this up, first of all, by reminding you that Governor Inslee is now warning that our state could face a catastrophic loss of medical care if COVID cases overrun our hospitals. So we want to know how close we are to that scenario and what does the situation look like right now in our local hospitals? So we are bringing in someone on the front lines of this pandemic. Dr. John Lynch is the director of the Infectious Diseases Clinic at Harborview, and he joins us now on the show. Good morning, Dr. Lynch.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much for joining us. So from your perspective, how serious is the COVID situation at this moment in our state and specifically at Harborview?
Yeah, I mean, I like to echo Governor Inslee. I mean, we are seeing a tremendous number of new cases in King County, in Seattle, and Washington State. And those increasing number of cases are definitely transitioning into hospitalizations. And we're seeing that at UW Medicine facilities, especially in South King County. My colleagues at Valley Medical Center are seeing a lot more patients. And we are as well here at Harborview. It is definitely a troubling trend.
When hospital beds fill up or there aren't enough people to care for the patients, what happens in that situation?
Yeah, sure. So I want to be clear right now, you know, medical facilities, hospitals, clinics are well staffed and able to provide all the care that is appropriate. But what we want to think about is what would it look like if the trends we're seeing right now continue out into the future? And I want to be very clear that that's what we're looking at. This isn't 1 week, 2 weeks, or even a month. This is something that could potentially be growing, increasing over the next several months. And if we get to the point where we don't have enough resources, we enter into what's called the crisis stands of care, which Governor Inslee mentioned. And I want to also be clear that decisions around those are made at the state level and at the regional level. Those aren't decisions that hospitals make, right? Those are decisions we make as healthcare communities, and are usually very well informed by the information that we're receiving. And should that ever happen, the extreme concern that we're seeing in other states is where the potential for rationing care starts playing a role. So instead of focusing on the absolute best way to take care of a patient, you're looking at what's the absolute best way to keep a health system functional.
To continue on with that, sir, so let's just say that, you know, this continues, or if it doesn't, and it starts to get to the point where decisions are made. Let's just say someone comes in for a heart attack or something else. How is the decision made inside of a hospital on who to care for first? Does it go by age? How does that work, sir?
Yeah, so I'm not an expert in crisis standards of care, and I would be relying upon people who are experts. And we have those experts in either medicine and other health systems and across the state. And so the first thing I'd say when we think about that is that the framework for how those decisions are made are a community framework. It's how we would, as a state, be moving forward. It wouldn't be me making that decision at Harborview. It would be a framework that we have all agreed upon as healthcare providers. And that framework would be working within a facility to make decisions that are agreed upon by the community, agreed upon by the providers, to look at what resource is short. Are we short on, for instance, dialysis machines? Are we short on this treatment? And then there would be a triaging based on underlying ethical principles that would inform who would best benefit from that that intervention.
Dr. Lynch, you know and you've heard that there is definite COVID fatigue, and it is coming at a time when we are seeing the cases increase. I'm going to bring up a couple of things that we often hear when people still try to argue that this is no worse than the flu. And I want you to respond from your perspective as the director of the Infectious Diseases Clinic. how is this different from the flu and what you were seeing in terms of what you're seeing this time of year when the flu cases are generally up anyway?
Yeah, so fortunately so far we haven't seen an uptick in influenza. And what I would say is different this year with COVID-19, what makes SARS-CoV-2 different is that when you look at the absolute number of people being infected, the proportion of people who are getting hospitalized is much greater. And in the fatality rate overall is also appears to be greater, but I would say is really, really, really elevated in at-risk groups, particularly older adults. You know, once you sort of hit 50s, it starts to creep up, 60s even more, 70s and 80s and so forth. It is also important to recognize that when you're looking at this many infections happening, we're seeing people ending up in the hospitals and clinics, emergency departments across the entire age spectrum. And unfortunately, that's also true in critical care. I've talked to colleagues at Seattle Children's and other facilities, and there are people in the ICUs across every age group, and the absolute numbers far, far, far exceed anything we've seen with influenza. You've seen the national statistics. You know, we're well over 250,000 deaths in the United States, incredible number of infections, and those are numbers that we do not see with influenza on a yearly basis. I've been doing this work for over a decade on following, for instance, influenza trends on a daily basis, and we've never seen anything like this ever before.
Dr. Lynch, I also want to speak about something that we're hearing more of, too, which is mental health issues among medical workers. I mean, there is serious burnout. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, and so you mentioned the pandemic fatigue, and I want to acknowledge that we're all feeling that, and I get it. I understand it completely. I'm exhausted. I think everyone I know in the community is exhausted by this. But I will just let folks know that the people at the bedside who are doing this care, they feel that pandemic fatigue 100 times over. To see, you know, yet another wave that is going out into the future indefinitely is overwhelming and more than exhausting. I don't know what the right terms are to use. And so what we need to do as a community is to take every action to prevent folks from getting sick with COVID-19, to help support these folks. You can just imagine if you're at the bedside in the ICU as a nurse, a respiratory therapist, you're seeing yet another person admitted with COVID-19, and you see people, you know, in bars and restaurants or attending large group gatherings out in the community, how that dissonance impacts your mental health. And so I would say the first thing I would call out is the community to take those actions to prevent that from happening to themselves, their family, their loved ones, or anyone else. And the second thing is, you know, acknowledgement. I, as someone who leads this work in UW Medicine, I have to be very clear and transparent and open to hearing the concerns and the distress of my colleagues who are taking care of patients, but really throughout the healthcare facilities everywhere.
This is the voice of Dr. John Lynch from the Infectious Diseases Clinic at Harborview. And Dr., PPE has been it was definitely a concern in a conversation early on in the beginning of this pandemic. Right now, do you guys have enough PPE for medical workers to get through a big surge?
Yes. So we have enough PPE to get through a big surge. You know, our world is adapted to this just-in-time supply chain, and healthcare systems are no different. And we do have enough. We've been planning for, increasing number of cases in the fall, winter, flu season. The real challenge, though, is that, you know, what happens next month? And I think that's been a serious stressor is, yes, we have enough right now. We think we're going to have enough next month. But that supply chain visibility going out to the future has remained very, very unstable. And so as an infectious diseases doctor involved with the COVID response in my system, you know, I've worked with my supply chain colleagues on a daily basis since February and having deep and hard discussions throughout all of this. And again, it's always thinking about what about next week? What about next month? And it's really unfortunate that even this far into it, we still have to have these conversations.
Okay, and then how about people? And I'm asking about people because in the beginning of this pandemic, the states, right? Like California was a state in the beginning. New York was a state, and Massachusetts. So it wasn't as many states across the country that were filled with COVID. And then what was happening, I saw, was that healthcare professionals were able to travel to these different states and maybe help out. Now that COVID cases have elevated in, quite frankly, a lot of all of the states right now, how about when it comes to people? Do you have enough people that are willing to go into this environment day to day after day?
Yeah. So, you know, again, with UW Medicine and other facilities, we have enough people to take care of patients as we always have to keep, maintain a very safe environment, do all the medical care that is appropriate. But we are taking actions in order to create more space and more staff. And with the UW Medicine, you've probably seen this in other media and other facilities are doing this. We've actually decided to dial back many of our non-urgent surgeries. These are procedures that would be done in the operating room, and the patient would have to then be in a bed in a hospital. And we are dialing those back in order to free up those staff, be able to provide the care that's needed in our ICUs and acute care floors, our regular hospital floors, and also create space, right, beds. It is very, very important to recognize that a bed is a thing, right? It's a place that someone can lie down. But what makes a hospital bed is the team that surrounds that bed and the patient who's in it. And those teams are definitely they're our most valuable resource. And we are definitely seeing across the country a shortage. And going back to your partner's question around, resources and crisis standards of care, it is more likely than not that the most stressed part of all this is staff. We can talk about PPE. We have lots of ways to mitigate that, but you cannot create a new respiratory therapist with the skill to operate a ventilator or to assess a patient. You can't create a critical care nurse, an acute care nurse, or an ICU doctor right out of thin air. There's ways to mitigate it, but that's really probably the most stressful part of this.
Dr. Lynch, with the time that we have remaining, so we are heading into a holiday weekend. We are still, probably months or maybe 6 months away from getting most people vaccinated. What do you think is most important for anyone listening right now to know? What is your message as we are at this juncture in our fight against this pandemic?
Yes, I think it's a great question. And I'd say there's two things. One is a short range. Listen, if people are traveling for Thanksgiving and spending time with their families, they've already made those plans. And, I'm going to respect that. What I would really strongly ask you to do is to check in with everyone you're going to be gathering with. If you're deciding to do that, make sure everyone's as healthy as possible going to that gathering. And if anyone has any concerns about their health, a headache, fatigue, often they're not showing up at your gathering, wear a mask. Wear masks by everyone in your gathering can be extremely powerful. Crack open those windows or even open them up a bit wider to get good airflow. Spend time outside and think about reducing how much time you're spending together. So if you're deciding to do that, there are a lot of things we could do to reduce the risk. So that's tomorrow, right? For those of you who are still on the fence, I still strongly recommend staying home and having the holiday with your household. For the long term, I think that's actually a thing that I would close with is, we still have a ways to go. We have months ahead of us of potentially increasing numbers unless we take strong actions to turn that down like we did in prior surges. And that's across the board. It's bars, it's restaurants, it's the gatherings, it's lots and lots of different things where we interact with folks, particularly with masks off. So get used to the masks. This is part of the current normal for the coming months throughout the winter season. There is potentially light at the end of the tunnel here. The information around the vaccines is extremely promising, but it is going to take time to get that out into folks. And so next year is really about how can we all work together to get all of us to that point of vaccination.
Dr. John Lynch, the director of the Infectious Diseases Clinic at Harborview, you have given us tremendously valuable information, and we thank you so much for your time. And please thank everyone that you work with for the great job that you all are doing. We do appreciate you. Thank you.
Thank you, and will do.
Wow. So in listening to that, right, and if there's one thing, and I'll share this, Ursula, 2020 has taken away, like there's been, and for me, there's been so much bad, I feel like, that has happened in 2020. It's to the point now where I'm starting to get numb to things that are happening. And lost my cousin in March in April to COVID. And now my father's sister probably won't make it this week. And so the reason why I'm bringing that up is I'm bringing it up to say, like, part of my hurt this week has been how I feel about it. And there's like this numbness. And sometimes you can be afraid to be numb. My mind is cloudy. I can't really think. Nothing really makes sense to me lately. I do this show, and it's probably the best 3 hours of my day. I don't sleep well right now. After the show, I feel like I'm a zombie, right? And the reason why I'm sharing this right now is I'm sharing it just to say that there's a lot of people in some way, shape, or form that are going through it. Maybe you don't have anybody that's contracted COVID. Maybe you haven't lost a family member to this. But businesses are being impacted. Jobs are being impacted. And it's really tough on a lot of people. And especially having that doctor on just now, it felt like a sense of comfort talking to him, because you can feel like, even though he was telling us the truth about what's going on, I really needed to hear his voice, because even though the truth, we don't like it, you can still tell that there was a confidence, and you can tell that he and the doctors at Harborview and doctors and nurses and staff everywhere are doing the best that they can to be there for us.
But, and well said, but the thing that I also took away from it's, if we feel burned out, imagine being on the front lines for 9 months and seeing patient after patient, many of them not making it. And so I'm going to take that to heart. And he said, you know, what you can do in the short term, but what you can do in the long term. And I think that just the more of, and someone pointed out, you know, everywhere I go, I see people wearing masks and there are, you know, cases still going up. So it can't work. No, we need to do these things consistently. And we need to do everything that we know that does work, because the faster that we can get this under control, the faster we can get back to normal.
Sure. All right. Well, coming up next, it's time to talk about family, and it's time to talk about things that your mom, your dad have maybe taught you going forward, because there's truly a lot of things to be thankful for. You guys are listening to the Gene Urshel Show.
Making the Gene Urshel Show a part of your morning routine. This hour of our show is brought to you by the Economy Fence Center. And if you missed our interview with Dr. John Lynch, the director of the Infectious Diseases Clinic at Harborview, I strongly recommend that you listen to our podcast as soon as it's posted on mynorthwest.com or anywhere else that you get your podcast, because his interview is definitely worth listening to. So here's a question. How do you learn to do things that dads would normally teach you if you don't have a dad yourself? In April, a guy named Rob Kenny started a YouTube channel called Dad, How Do I to Solve That Problem?
Have you ever run into a problem around the house and thought, a dad would know how to fix this?
No, that's about it.
Enter Rob Kenny.
Hey, kids.
He's become a father figure to millions through his YouTube channel, Dad, How Do I? He shares encouraging, informative tutorials on how to do routine tasks like unclogging a sink.
Okay, and then just kind of scrub around here.
And jump-starting a car.
Okay, some other things that he teaches, stereotypical dad lessons like how to shave your face, how to use a stud finder. He started the channel to teach life lessons that he never learned from his own father, who he said had walked out on his family when he was a child, and now he has nearly 3 million subscribers.
That's awesome.
I know. I love it. I love the idea. So we were talking in our morning meeting, lessons that we have learned from our parents.
Right.
And I know that you've spoken so much about your dad and your mom.
Yeah.
But what are some of the lessons that stick out to you?
Well, I'll tell you what. I can't fix anything. That's because my dad couldn't either. And my dad would always say, hey, don't be messing with the employment line. You got to help people out. People need to work. If you want to try to do something and you can't do it right, then what are you doing? You're actually messing things up for other people. That's why you want to hire folks. So he's like, you got to keep people with jobs. So that was my dad's thing when it comes to fixing. But I you know, every day that I do this show, and there's things that I say, and I always say to myself, I think about my dad more during the 3-hour show that we do than any part of my day. And that's because a lot of the topics that we're talking about, it's just life, right? Mm-hmm. Like everything we're talking about is what we are actually dealing with. And sometimes when I say things, I'll say to myself, Ursula, yeah, my dad wouldn't like that I said that. You know what I mean? Because my dad was such a peaceful man. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Way more so than me. So I just think I learned a lot about how to treat people. That's probably the best thing that my father ever taught me.
And if you could just dig a little bit deeper, so in how to treat people, I mean, what would he say about that?
When I went to military school and I would be talking about racism and I'd talk about things and I'd ask him why he doesn't get mad about different things when it comes to racism and look at what you've gone through and you went to the military and when you came back, you went and fought in the war and you couldn't even get a home for yourself. Why do you not get upset about that? And he always says, I can get upset if you want me to, mm-hmm. but how is that going to help you?
Mm.
So he says, so while you're at that school, he said, I'm sending you to that military school so that you can learn and be better. And so that you can teach your children to be better. And then it continues from there. So I don't send you to that military school because I think that you're going to go there and try to racism while you're there. I want you to go there and I want you to understand and learn and be around different cultures so then that you can be better. I want you to be better than me. So that is an example of him.
Mm-hmm. So when I think about my own dad, my dad, like your dad, I mean, he wasn't a fixer. I mean, so I never learned how to change a tire. I still don't know how to do that. And thankfully, I have a AAA membership. But some of the things that have really stuck with me, a couple of things. One is my dad always said, instead of buying something, the things that are most meaningful to me are what you show or what you create, what you write. So I've always put so much more value on written cards and expressing emotions. And that is something I think that is from my dad. Also, my dad is a big fighter for equality. And even where he is right now in his assisted living facility, he's always about what is right. I mean, sometimes to the point where it makes it very difficult. But he will fight for even people at his place where he's at right now. He says, this person's not eating. And he will make sure that he finds the staff member who can help make sure that this person will eat and not be given up on after first refusal of food. So he's always trying to stick up for other people. And I think that's a great lesson that I have learned from him. And he is the father of 5 children, and none of us ever felt like we were favorites. So he was always very fair about that. And so that is something that I learned. And just I want to throw in my mom, too, because you learn a lot of lessons from mom as well. And, you know, in that, I think is, you know, trying to get along. I think that's something that I've learned from my mom. I've also learned things that I do differently from my mom. I mean, she is blunt. She says things that are just like right there in your face. And I learned to be different from that. But I think that she is really good about also knowing when to spread kindness. And so I think that's a big lesson from her. How about you, Chef?
Oh, man. From my dad, I think from my dad, I learned what it means to be a man, and that being a man is not about, you know, the car you drive, the girls you hook up with, the clothes you wear, the job you have. Being a man is being there for your family every day, coming home after work, showing up for the events, showing love and respect and care for your wife, doing the hard things instead of the easy things. You know, my parents raised my brother, my older brother and I, and my younger brother was severely handicapped. And seeing how much they sacrificed for us and for my brother, I mean, that's what being a man is to me, is being there for your family. I learned that from him. Thank you, Dad.
I love that. If I could add to, for both my parents, I mean, my parents have been through a lot, and they stuck together. And my mom made huge sacrifices to keep our family together, and that is something that I'll always be appreciative of my mom, for sure.
You know, Ursula, you talked about your mom being blunt. My mom called me yesterday morning.
Uh-huh.
And this is how it sounds. Hey, I want you to get that Obama book for me. Get that new Obama book for me for Christmas, okay? Okay, Mom. Okay, I ain't want nothing. I just want the Obama book for Christmas. Okay, bye. That was a conversation. That was a conversation. Okay, you want me to buy you the book for Christmas? Okay. Oh, this is awesome. Coming up next, it is now time for scenarios. It's a time where you don't always have to say that Chef is right, because yesterday you guys didn't want to say it, but he's not always right all the time. So we discuss that next. It's the Gene Ursa Show. Happy Thanksgiving Eve, everybody. Welcome into the Gene Ursa Show. Coming up in 15 minutes, it is time for Ursula and I to agree to disagree. We do that next. But right now, it's time for scenarios.
Here we go, yo. Here we go, yo. So what's the scenario?
G, Ursula, and Chef, here's the deal. I'm about to get a big job offer that could be a life changer for me. But I'm scared. I'm perfect for this job and nailed the interview. The company has checked my background and said to expect an offer this week. Then the HR director called and said they wanted a few more references just for their files. I had already provided 5 and they called 3 of them. She wanted 3 more. I gave them 2 good ones but couldn't think of another. So I put down a friend from an old job I worked at. Now, he wasn't a boss, but he was a peer. I didn't think anything of it because it seemed like they just wanted it for the record, for their files, so they say. Well, yesterday, he texted me and wanted to know why this company was calling for reference on me. Mm-hmm. I called and explained and asked him to cover, but he won't do it. Said he could get in trouble for it and was going to be honest. And then he said, and if I talk to them, my reference isn't going to help you that much. I always thought you were overrated when you were here in the first place. Now I'm freaking out because this could possibly ruin everything. I need a little help here. 98973 State Roofing Text Line. Ursula, you up to bat first.
Okay, so first of all, before you write down names that you can use as references, you need to check with those people to make sure.
Yes.
So that would be the first thing. That is the first thing that I tell everybody. When trying to give advice on putting together your resume, you can't just put someone down as a reference. And by the way, if someone asks and calls you and asks, can you be my reference? Can I put you down as a letter, as a recommendation? Don't say yes if you're not going to say something good. Right? I would just be honest right off the bat. I've had to actually tell somebody because there have been people who have worked here before. And they have asked, not very often. I mean, most often I will give a great recommendation. But if someone's not good, I'm not going to pass off that problem to somebody else. So I will tell that person, I don't think it's a good idea to have me as your letter of reference. So now with this problem, I mean, he's just got to take it. If the company calls, if he's that good, he's nailed everything, they're not going to change on one poor recommendation, especially now this is like the fourth or fifth. If they really want him, they're going to take him, even if there's one who's going to be, you know, maybe not sterling.
Are you sure, Ursula?
Well, unless they say something that is just a deal breaker. I'm not sure. No.
Chef, what you think, man?
I'm surprised by your former coworker. I thought his first reaction would have been, hey, this company called me up and asked me for a reference, so I got to know, since I thought you were highly overrated, how much is this worth to you? I'm surprised he did not go that route. Here's the deal. I mean, basically, you could try to bribe him to lie, or you just have to, like Ursula said, stick with it. Because, look, man, like, if I called five references and one was a coworker who said the guy was overrated, I'd be like, that's weird, but it just sounds like sour grapes. Mm-hmm. I'm going to let it go. However, Ursula, I will say that you are wrong in this way. You do not have an obligation to provide a good reference for someone who has asked you for one. You do not have to automatically decline if you think poorly of them. In fact, I can think of one person on this show who would delight in sharing a negative reference if asked. Hey, you want me to be a reference for you?
Okay, oh, that's yeah, not me. Sure. Who are you talking ahead. About?
I don't know.
Okay, let me ask you, G. Would you, if you knew that you were going to torch someone's possibility of getting a job because they were not good, would you say, hey, yeah, go ahead, put me down?
So here's, I'm going to go ahead and just tell you what has been going on now in my life. Now, back in my 20s and early 30s, you know, like, hey, man, I need you as a reference. Okay, cool, whatever. I was cool with that. But I've noticed something. I've noticed that a lot of people now hit me up. Hey, G, I need you for a job reference. And here's the deal. I tell them, hey, don't ask me, because if it's me, if my name is on the line and I have to tell and put my name onto something, I'm telling the truth. Mm-hmm. So friend or not friend, that's it. Hey, do you think this person is dependable? No, I don't.
Mm-hmm.
I am not putting my name on anything unless I am telling the truth. I am not going to be saying like, oh, yo, they're great and did this and, oh, yeah, they lived with me. No, I am not. So if you want the truth, absolutely. Call me, put me down as a reference. If you don't want the truth, then I'm not a good reference to have.
Yeah, only because I've been on the other end in hiring. I would just rather have people who can speak to someone's strengths, and I would not want to waste my time although I suppose if you are an employer and someone ends up giving me a horrible recommendation, I mean, it's just basically someone saying I would not recommend this person, then I would obviously, even if there's four others, I suppose you could also say they didn't do their homework.
Yeah.
And that's not a good sign either. So, yeah.
And then another thing, too, sounds like Buddy ain't getting the great references that he thought. Because if they keep continuing to ask him for more, that means those other references, they're not exactly, some ain't matching up. Somebody kind of gave him some not so favorable information. That's coming up next, it is time to agree to disagree. You guys are listening to Gene Ursula Show.